Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture. Brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
Welcome to the Table, where we discuss issues of God and culture. And our topic for today is the Old Testament and archaeology. And I have with me two guests, Steve Ortiz from Southwestern Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, and Gordon Johnson, who is a professor of Old Testament here at Dallas. And we're going to consider how what we call the realia, how the things that we find in the ground and on the earth and the remains of history that we dig up help us to understand what's going on with the Bible. And so, Steve, I'm going to ask you to begin by telling us a little bit about your background and in working with archaeology and what you've done, what you bring to this conversation in terms of your background.
Well, I'm currently the director of the Tandy Institute for Archaeology at Southwestern. We have three field projects. I'm one of the co-directors of Tau Gezer. It's a major research project and a major Old Testament site, one of the three cities that Solomon fortified. I'm a graduate of University of Arizona, a student of Dr. Deaver, one of the big names in biblical archaeology. Mm-hmm. And I've been going to Israel, consider myself a dig bum. You feed me, I'll dig for you. So 30 years of experience and probably over 10 sites or so that I've been a staff member of.
And all Old Testament sites or?
From the modern period, as you know, New Testament sites is on top of an Old Testament site. Uh-huh. So even an Old Testament archaeologist has to go through modern history.
Has to work their way
down. I apologize for a New Testament scholar to consider modern history.
Yeah, but well, yes, but we'll get by Jesus yes, and go back to the Old Testament. Yes. I know how that works. So that's great. Well, and Gordon, what about your own experience in this area?
Well, Steve majors in archaeology and minors in the Bible. I major in the Bible and minor in archaeology.
Okay.
My training is in Hebrew and ancient Near Eastern languages, texts, ancient Near Eastern history. And I got involved in archaeology about 15 years ago, 20 years ago, in terms of participating in mm-hmm. digs. So I've been on about a half dozen digs just as a slave labor, and then as square supervisors. So my area is in terms of trying to keep my ear to the ground uh-huh. and my eye to the page in terms of what the archaeologists are discovering and how that relates and impacts the Bible.
Okay, you used a phrase that I probably have to interpret for people, and this will help us transition into how archaeology works, and that is you said you were a square supervisor. Now I could listen to that and say, are you supervising squares What exactly does that mean?
Well, when we, as Steve could give more detail on this, when we dig, we're not just digging down holes to try to find something. You plot out a 5-meter by 5-meter square, mm-hmm. and you dig down layer by layer.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have people that are digging, and then you have people, a square supervisor that's watching mm-hmm. to make sure that things are not being destroyed too badly as we go down, and then records what's being found.
Because you really have to be very meticulous about how you go down as you go. And so there's a lot of care. You don't just take a shovel and dig down deep, right?
Correct. And this is one of the issues with archaeology. It's mm-hmm. even within archaeology we debate, is archaeology a science or is it humanities,
mm-hmm.
and it's both. We're discovering history, so historians are interested in the archaeological record, like Gordon is.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's that aspect, the scientific aspect, where the dig itself, where you have to control everything that's coming out, taking careful measurements, the recording system, and most field projects involve several layers of staff. And so the square supervisor is the one that's right there watching everything, recording everything, and it kind of rests on their shoulders. And then you have a field archaeologist controlling several square archaeologists, and then you have the director where I'm at, where we don't do anything except give orders.
Okay, so you've got to give us a little bit of a taste of a field. Let's do this in two segments. Let's talk about archaeology in general, what it can and can't do for us, and then let's talk about, okay, what is a dig like? How does that actually work. So let's talk about archaeology first. You know, some people's image of the archaeologist is kind of...
Indiana Jones.
Yeah, there you go. I had to do it. I mean, you knew it was coming. You know, and so it's this guy who wears this great hat, and it's pretty adventurous, and he's, you know...
They do wear hats. But it's not very adventurous.
That's right, yeah. And they just kind of, you know, it's the quest, you know, for the Holy Grail and varieties of things like that. But it actually is a much more... a mundane process, isn't it? And what is it that actually we can and can't learn from archaeology?
Well, that's a loaded question. Yeah, the history of archaeology has been treasure hunting. Mm-hmm. The most people's perception of archaeology is you're going finding nice treasures.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that is true. We're finding, you know, there's some important things that help reconstruct history. But the majority of archaeology, if you think what archaeology does, we're historians that look at the material culture.
Mm-hmm.
So where you gentlemen will be interested in the text, in, you know, what's going on here, your iPad, mm-hmm. the text, I'm interested in the actual material components of this event that's going on here. And so I'll come and I'll study the table, the mics, the coffee cups, and try to reconstruct what took place here.
Right.
We're a textual scholar, or biblical scholar will look at the text itself to reconstruct what happened here.
Yeah, except the important thing here that shows the connection between the two is that what you're looking at is actually the physical layout of where people lived, the way in which their lives were constructed, if I can say that, what the rooms that they lived in looked like, the utensils that they used, that kind of, that's actually what you're finding, and that's what's, you're helping to give a portrait, helping to put, if I can say, flesh on the bones of what is in a text. Would that be a fair way to think about this?
Yes, I would say more context.
Uh-huh.
We're placing that text within its, as you said, cultural context, mm-hmm. historical context. Most people, you know, when they read the Bible, they think that's all of history.
Mm-hmm.
And they forget to realize that God's word occurred over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
It occurred in many cultures. And so it just gives us that reflection of what God did and what he wanted recorded. But as a biblical archaeologist, I'm looking for all the other stuff. Like you said, the living conditions, how people lived.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things that aren't recorded in the biblical text.
Mm-hmm.
Even things like grain that you find that's in the ground, or just little skeletons of little animals and things like that, which for most people that are interested in the Bible would seem to be very trivial. But it helps you reconstruct the culture and the history of what was happening.
And the lifeways of how people lived, yeah.
Yeah, and we'll come back to one of those examples, because one of the topics we're eventually going to get to is camels, not pet camels, but camels, and how they are impacted by this. Okay, so that's what you're looking for. Another impression that often comes with archaeology is, and then when I'm done with this, I'm going to ask Gordy a question, but is that the Bible can be proved by archaeology, and I actually think this is another place where people can sometimes be misled about what archaeology is and is not able to do. How do we deal with what archaeology can actually do for us, and what can it do for us?
Well, as I said, it gives us the context. Mm-hmm. It can prove the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
It can also disprove the Bible, depending. Keep in mind that we find rocks, bones, pottery,
mm-hmm.
and it's that layer of interpretation,
mm-hmm.
that reconstructing history where we're all debating.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to argue if you found a rock,
right,
or if that's a piece of pottery. We all agree on that. It's the significance of all that material culture put together to reconstruct, in this case, a biblical event or highlighting a biblical book. And one of the problems I have with students or when I teach Sunday school is most people have a simplistic equation. They find a verse in the Bible, and they tell me, okay, give me the archaeology for that verse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you have the world that ancient Israel lived in. You have the recording of those events, God acting in that world. And there's a many layers to get to that level of that biblical text. And so today, most biblical archaeologists aren't looking for that one you know, silver bullet that's going to address the question. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, we got to look at the whole world and reconstruct it. And so you need text guys looking at the text. You need material culture guys looking at the material culture. And somewhere we pull that together and we're able to give a picture of how the biblical text was formed in its culture. And then the theologians come along and how does that apply to our lives?
So when you say prove or disprove the Bible, what you mean is that archaeology's generated debates about that relationship, and that actually there's quite a lot of both gathering of material and interpretation that comes into those conversations. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay, Gordy. Now, when you think about archaeology and what it is able to do for us, or what it's not able to do for us, how do you answer that question?
Well, Steve laid it out very clearly. What I try to help the students understand is that philosophically speaking, you can't prove anything with 100% certainty at all. Mm-hmm. And so now we're looking at what is a relative degree of certainty, and so we have to have realistic expectations. People on the far right of fundamentalism often are trying to argue that archaeology, you know, proves the Bible, and they're just looking for the silver bullet that Steve's talking about. On the other hand, people that tend to be more negative are looking for things to try to disprove the Bible. But what we're looking for is I think the key is that we need to adopt attached neutrality, mm-hmm. that we come to the text with no expectations, not trying to prove or disprove, but just to lay it out and to see where the evidence goes.
Your point is that what you're digging up is you're trying to make sense out of the life that is reflected in the materials that are raised, and then
the material that you find doesn't interpret itself. The stones
right.
don't speak.
That's
and
right.
So there's always an interpretation. In the same way with the Bible, the Bible's not self-interpreting. You're always coming and asking questions of the text. And sometimes the archaeology might point away from a traditional reading of the text.
Mm-hmm.
Some people might think, well, then it's disproving the Bible. It may be disproving my
Sunday
school
of
reading
it.
Of
That's
it.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then demanding maybe a more sophisticated reading of that text.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For example, take like Joshua's conquest.
Right.
In the old days, we'd go, okay, Joshua had a conquest. We should find a Pompeii.
Mm-hmm.
And so archaeologists went looking for dead Canaanite bodies strewn around mm-hmm. the Promised Land.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, warfare is a lot more complicated. When you say you conquered a site, it doesn't necessarily mean you had death and destruction and you're going to find 90% of a site destroyed. We find burnt mud brick. We find in abandoned cities.
Mm-hmm.
And we put all that together. And probably the key word now that we deal with, and Gordon mentioned it, is historical plausibility.
Mm-hmm.
We don't look for direct proof. Mm-hmm. This isn't like a logic or science where you add chemicals and you determine.
Yeah, I can't recreate historical events. They happen once, whereas mm-hmm. in science, I get to recreate the circumstances and test right. whether or not something works or not.
And we're not trying to prove. Yeah. What we're trying to ask the question is, can we make a sound case for the reliability of the text that you can take this text seriously?
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about the Bible. It's not going to be able to prove the intervention of God.
Mm-hmm.
You can find the right stuff in the right place at the right time.
Right.
But archaeology can't put God there in the dirt, in the spade.
Right.
And what the Bible's proving is that God was intervening here.
Mm-hmm.
So all we can ask is, what we're finding in the dirt, does it match, does it fit, is the right stuff, the right place at the right time with the harmonization between the Bible and archaeology?
What has helped me is all the CSI movies. Because
mm-hmm.
I can go, because everybody's seen a CSI movie.
Right, right.
And I say, that's what archaeologists do. We find fragments of evidence
mm-hmm.
and we reconstruct. We know that an event happened. There was a crime here.
Mm-hmm.
There was a dead body.
Mm-hmm.
Who did it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you got to find all the pieces of evidence to reconstruct. And what they do in the courtroom is provide the best picture or reconstruction of what they think happened based on the scientific data, rules of evidence. And that's what archaeologists are doing. We're taking those pieces, fragments, and reconstructing it. Now, in the case of the Old Testament, we're saying, is the Old Testament account historically plausible? Here's what we know. Does it make sense compared to the pieces of evidence we find on the ground? And that's where the debate happens, and a lot of times it happens in the media. And
mm-hmm.
that's where your audience will see, you know,
see the, see
archaeology,
the
yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, that gives us a feel kind of for what archaeology can and to some degree can't do for us. Let's turn to the actual dig itself and what that looks like. So I'm going to try and picture this for people. You walk up to a space and you think, okay, this site we think may have something there, okay? You know, the technical term sometimes you hear is a tell. So I walk up and I'm starting from scratch. What happens on a dig?
chaos, actually. No. well, normally, and Gordon kind of gave the process.
Uh-huh. What most start, though, with the trench
yes.
cut, though. The trowel trench
yeah.
cut on the
what
side.
What most before. People don't realize uh-huh. is most these tiles that you mentioned, they're uh-huh. just these mounds. They're the an ancient city
right.
that's been rebuilt and rebuilt.
Right.
And archaeologists, major projects, probably only excavate about 5 or 10% of that ancient city.
Right.
And so the first thing you want to do is you go like, if I only have 5 or 10%, where do I want to dig?
Uh-huh.
And that's when archaeologists will set up a grid system.
Mm-hmm.
They do a survey based on other sites. So you kind of go like, okay, let's probably on the Acropolis is where the king lived.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we want to dig somewhere up on the Acropolis. Let's look for a low area where we think might be the city gate.
Okay.
Gordon mentioned a trench.
Mm-hmm.
There's one section, kind of like a cake. You go like, well, let's give a broad picture of the whole history of these cities. And somewhere we want to kind of, you know, dig this trench
mm-hmm.
where kind of like the, you just see the layers. Here's an example here,
yep.
the backdrop here
yep.
of the various cities.
Uh-huh.
And so you kind of, as a director, set up 5 or 6 areas. We're going to kind of address all these issues. And part of it's based on your research design.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an Old Testament archaeologist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm digging Gezer. Mm-hmm. Well, we have a major Hellenistic city
mm-hmm.
on Gezer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not interested in the Hellenistic period.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to be responsible, so I'll try to find an area that doesn't have a lot of Hellenistic overgrowth on it.
Hmm.
Otherwise, I'm going to spend 3 years excavating a Hellenistic city.
Because you can't get the approval just to dig down to the layer that you're interested in. If you dig down, you have to work historically all through the layers. Isn't that regulated to some degree?
Because archaeology is a destructive science.
Yes, exactly.
And
you can't do it a second time. You never get a chance to look at that square or that layer a second time.
That's right.
No, what happens is an archaeological team has many scholars involved with it.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd get a Hellenistic scholar who's interested in that city.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd say, okay, you're going to publish this,
mm-hmm.
or your scholarship's going to just be on this part of the city here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the city down here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll be excavating this part.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
And you're talking about, by saying down here, you're talking about as you work through the layers, you're actually working through the history from the more recent to the more ancient as you go lower and lower.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. I have all kinds of questions I want to ask now. So basically you section this out and then you very carefully, at least if you do this right, carefully and systematically work your way down a layer at a time.
And it's like peeling a layer off a cake.
Right.
Instead of digging holes.
You know, I have a picture at Capernaum, I think is where it was taken, it's Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Maritima, sorry. It's Caesarea Maritima. I have a picture, and you can see the layers beautifully of clay and other things that take you down. I don't know. I have no idea how many years I'm looking at when I look at this. It's right on the edge of where the Hippodrome was. And it's a fascinating picture because it illustrates not only the layers, but really how far down you have to go to get to the more ancient site. Sometimes you're digging quite deep. Isn't
some
that correct?
Some sites, 15, 20, 25 different strata.
Yeah.
And how deep would that be? I mean, how deep might that go?
Each city's unique and different.
Uh-huh.
Jericho, you've got to look back to the Neolithic, which is the first time that you've got cities.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about how large. I mean, I visited Jericho. I mean, I have a sense of what that would be. But we're not talking inches here. We're talking feet and yards, right?
Well, you mentioned Caesarea Maritima.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Roman, you know, city, Hellenistic city.
Right.
They built their harbor, and it can be, you know, 5 meters can just be one layer of some support structure that they built. And so some of these sites, you have to use a bulldozer to remove that overburden. The example, I'm working at Gezer. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the 10th century and the transition to statehood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Solomonic period.
Right.
I've been there 6 years, uh-huh. You know, six field seasons, uh-huh. And I still haven't got to Solomon yet.
Uh-huh.
And people are asking me, when are you getting? I go like, well, I have to remove the Hellenistic. I have to remove the 8th century. I have to.
You're just killing people.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, yeah, I'm still in 2 Kings. I haven't got to, you know. Yeah.
Funny story. I was at a site a number of years ago in which we were excavating at the city gate. There was one square that had gotten down to late Bronze Age period.
Which is?
1550, 1400, right.
Okay.
It was the period, the area that we wanted to go to.
BC, about.
That's
yeah.
right.
Okay.
And so we decided to open up another square right next to it that I was doing, and we all wanted to get down to that level.
Uh-huh.
And we had the dig I was on, we were doing 2 weeks at a time. My students wanted to just dig down fast, and I said, we've got to be careful because we don't know what's underneath the ground. And so I kept
holding it. And I know you well enough to know that you're going to be careful. So
yeah, yeah. And I kept holding him back and holding him back, and then we were getting right to the level that was almost level with the square next to us. Our time was over. The next group came in the following weekend for 2 weeks, and they were telling us afterwards, you wouldn't believe everything we found. The very first day, stuff started coming out of the dirt. And, of course, my crew was mad at me. And I told, no, you've got to understand, we helped them to set that up. So otherwise, we would have destroyed half of the stuff if we'd gone down too quickly.
Now, one of the things that we often hear, and I think this taking the time to do this helps people, is that sometimes what you hear, the way sites are discovered is that they're just building in the city. They, you know, but Jerusalem in particular, I think, is subject to this, where they'll dig down, and as they're digging down for the, you know, to lay the foundation for building a building or whatever, or constructing a highway or whatever it is, all of a sudden they come across something, and Israel is very, very sensitive about her antiquities, and so sometimes that can put a hold on a project. They care that much about their history.
Oh, yes. And we do the same thing here in the United States. Mm-hmm. We don't see it, but every time you build a new road, mm-hmm. you have an archaeological survey. The only difference is in Israel, every piece of land has history on it.
That's right.
So if you go add a backyard deck, you're mm-hmm. excavating a mosaic or something, and mm-hmm. that's just the nature of the site. Take the Siloam Pool. I mean, mm-hmm. this is famous. This is right. where Jesus healed.
Right.
And they were just redoing a sewer line.
That's right.
And they made this big discovery just by a simple sewer line.
And in fact, if you walk there today, I think we're talking about the same site.
You can still see part of the sewer
running through the site. I had to dig around that. I can understand why. And so, it's interesting how you hear about this. The one that I think about that I'm most familiar with directly, not because I've ever worked on an archaeological site, but because I've dealt with the hype that has surrounded it, was the Talpiot tomb. The Talpiot tomb, where supposedly they found these tombs with the name of Jesus's family on it, was big about a decade ago. But that they were building apartments. In fact, you go there today, and the apartments are all around it. So they had to. And when they built the building, which is really interesting, when they ended up building the building, they ended up building it in such a way that they could preserve the contents of this site, so that now if you want to see what's in there, you have to drop cameras in there and that kind of thing. So it's interesting, the effort that's been made by people who are sensitive to this to try and preserve these spots if they decide not to dig in them. But oftentimes, and this is one of the parts of the history that I think people may not be aware of, is that in the past, some people were just diggers. You know, they just went down and tried to go for what they were going for. And as you mentioned, archaeology is a destructive science, so that once you dig it up and you mess it up, it's messed up.
Well, Jericho, the last occupation levels at Jericho are just a mess,
mm-hmm.
because the first number of digs in the late 1800s, early 1900s, they were just treasure hunting. Mm-hmm. Didn't know the initial dig, didn't even know what the site was,
mm-hmm.
and it was just messed up.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of things that we might want to see, you know, are not available because they didn't keep careful records. They were just digging, and the whole top layer was basically removed.
And this raises another issue that often comes up, particularly when things are announced in the public, and that has to do with It really is important to be able to try, if possible, to catalog where things come from, what is around it, that kind of thing. And when things just show up in a shop, in an antiquity shop, and it's undocumented, or a scholar is just handled, as with the Jesus Wife's text — this is a New Testament issue, or actually a post-New Testament issue — Jesus Wife's text, and we don't know where it came from, anything about it. All we have is the paper and the ink. We really don't have much context to sort out exactly what it is that we're dealing with.
Correct, and it's important, as you know, we've illustrated here. Archaeology, one of the key factors is stratigraphy, mm-hmm. or dating it. Mm-hmm. We need that object to know what level it came from, mm-hmm. and like the Talpiot tombs you mentioned, mm-hmm. these, you know, Second Temple, mm-hmm. you know, New Testament era, you know, bone coffins. Mm-hmm. We need to know if they came from outside of Jerusalem, inside the city, mm-hmm. nearby, if they date, you know, to 30 BC or 30 AD.
Right, which can, right.
The expression is in situ,
right,
where it was located in the situation and documented and photographed. If anything just shows up that was not documented in situ, archaeologically speaking, it just has to be discounted, because what do you do with it?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a big debate about, you know, where's the trail of evidence? But it's unfortunate. You just don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, and you see that happening with this Jesus Wife text, because we don't know. We know it's a Coptic text. We think we know the papyrus now has been dated to somewhere between the 5th and 9th century AD. So it's a early Christian historical text, or fairly early. It's actually in the normal range of where some of our manuscripts are found, even for the New Testament. But they couldn't test the ink, because that would have destroyed the small piece that you had. And there are just lots of things about it we don't know. All we have are parts of 8 lines. There's no context around it. We don't have anything introducing it. We don't know what the debate is surrounding the affirmation that's made. We don't even know if, in the midst of saying that Jesus had a wife, if there's another part of the section that says, oh, no, he didn't.
Yeah.
You know, so this is
the problem, because a lot of the sites we want to dig at, you can only dig with a credentialed excavation a couple months of the year, and those mm-hmm. sites just lie open mm-hmm. the rest of the year. So people will come and rob those sites out, and they don't understand, you know, the importance of having it documented. They're just going to pull something out of the ground and say, here, I got something, mm. and they don't realize that they're really doing a disservice.
So there's a lot that goes into this. That's the point. I mean, we've been careful taking our time to do this, because we want people to have a sense and a kind of a portrait of how this works and how complicated it can be. And it really is. There really is a lot that goes into managing a dig. you have a reason to work, don't you? Yeah. So is there anything else that we should say about just the structure of archaeology, or the way digs work, that we haven't mentioned that should be mentioned, as we're kind of overviewing before we look at some particulars?
Well, one of the main things, especially within biblical archaeology or archaeology of the Middle East, one of the unique features of the Middle East is the volunteer program. Mm-hmm. Most digs have professional archaeologists, which is very labor-intensive, time-consuming. Mm-hmm. But in the Middle East, they've used people who are just interested. So like at Gezer, I probably only have a staff of 20, mm-hmm. but 40 others are volunteers, students who've never dug before, that are going to the Holy Land. And so most digs are, they're a teaching program also.
Hmm.
So it's not like we just get slave labor. It's like students come over and we're just going to use
it's
you for 5
labor,
weeks.
Which some
yes.
people say is the same thing.
yeah, it is. Yeah.
This is setting up Steve for his advertisement.
Yes, but
that's what's unique. And people ask me, I would love to just dig with the crew of 20 experienced archaeologists.
Mm-hmm.
Like Gordon gave the example. He had students on a dig. He had to fight them to dig properly.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, this is proper archaeology. I know you would love to get there, but you have to document it first.
Mm-hmm. And ironically, the young college students that are men mm-hmm. are usually the ones you have to pull back the most because they've got their testosterone raging and, and they want to dig down fast. It's actually the girls that are the easier to manage because they'll listen to you and they'll go slow.
I'm not going there.
but that's one major component of Neerson Diggs, that study component, and it's unique. And, you know, many people that will be listening to this podcast have probably gone on a dig or are thinking of going on a dig. So that's what's one thing unique.
So if you go, you're going for a few weeks at a time, and you're working all day in the heat, and it's not glamorous. It really is a lot of work, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So be prepared if you're going to spend your money for your vacation that way. That's what it involves. Now, so do you go every summer, basically?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And you've been several times in the last several years.
Been a number of times.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that's kind of our overview. So let's transition. And let's talk about some specific finds, and in particular, what we're interested in here is dealing with the hype that comes with archaeology a lot of times. And we're seeing this in New Testament studies as well, so this is not a problem that's unique to the Old Testament. And I'm going to make an observation, and I just want to get your reaction to it. There was a time in which the way this worked is you did your dig. You wrote up your study. You had it vetted by people who knew what they were looking at. It was presented to the public in a very scholarly and organized kind of way. And there's a lot of study that still is done that way. But it strikes me that in the last 20 to 25 years, I don't know how much longer this has been, that we've had a lot of things happen that don't work that way. That basically a scholar has gotten a hold of a site. He's gotten a hold of an artifact, maybe more accurately, or a set of artifacts. And what he has done is, rather than go through the normal vetting process and the normal scholarly process, he's connected with a media organization of one kind or another to promote what it is that he's doing. He presents his case, not necessarily before scholars in a vetted kind of way, but directly to the public, and we're off and running. You know, I kind of remember the beginning of the Kentucky Derby, you know, and they're off, and boom, it's in the public square, and we're off and running, and we seem to have things backwards.
Well, it's not done with sinister motivation.
Yeah.
Archaeology is very expensive, and money has to be raised, and in many cases, and even mustering interest in people being involved in it. So part of that's understandable. It's a way of promoting it. But what happens is that sometimes a story in the press gets ahead of the balance.
Know.
That's right.
Yeah. So oftentimes when we get the hyped event, what we'll get is the hype first and then the reflection. And really, we don't know what we have until we've gone through that entire process. Is that a fair way to kind of describe what's sometimes is happening today?
Yeah, and you have both. I put out a press release every season, and I hope that Fox News will pick it up and it'll hit the, you know, it'll make me famous and people want to give money to the dig. But I put a responsible press release out. I don't sensationalize it, and you know, I'm tempted to say Jesus walked on the site just to, you know, but I know that is not historically accurate. And so I don't fault the archaeologist for
doing promotion.
Something like that. Yeah.
The problem is that when the press, that they're often not as nuanced, and when an archaeologist will say might or could, the press is not sensitive,
and they don't parse sentences.
That's right, and it gets written up as it was.
Yeah.
So they don't always understand the nuances, and it sometimes gets overplayed that way.
And there's some scholars that, like you said, it's like, you know what, this is so sensational, I should vet it with other colleagues. This changes history. Was Jesus really buried south of Jerusalem? Is that where his family was when the texts talk about him being from Galilee?
Right.
This is so sensational. You should present it.
Yeah, would their family tomb even be in Jerusalem?
Yes, yeah. And would it be a wealthy tomb?
That's,
you know,
right.
He came from a poor family. So there's a lot of questions where this should be presented to the scholarly community for them to vet it and say, like the CSI situation, we've heard your case. We think you have the evidence. You presented it. You know, this is, you know, publish this.
Okay, well, let's go through some examples that are recent that have made the public square. They've hit the Richter scale, if I can say it that way. And I think of two in particular to start off with, two particular fines that really hit the press the beginning of this year, 2014. And one of them had to do with the discovery of a text that described, I think it was Babylonian, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. But anyway, actually, it's ancient, more ancient
Sumerian.
Than that. It's Sumerian, yeah. But it describes the Ark as a kind of circle. Now, I'm just a few weeks away from having seen Noah the movie, so I know, according to Hollywood, that Ark wasn't round, okay? The ark that rode in the flood. And of course, we have several issues here. We have the traditions about the flood that go outside of Israel, and then we have the texts that describe the particulars of that event, which is a widespread tradition across many cultures. And then we have this particular find. And so we heard in the press all kinds of things being argued about the significance of what this meant. So I think I'm going to start here, because here we're dealing with the contents of what was found, and what's described isn't debated. It's where it fits that gets debated. So here I'm turning to the historian amongst us and say, okay, so what should I do with this when I hear this?
Well, my first
reaction. And I haven't seen the movie yet, so I'm not going to look at that.
Okay. Yeah. So my first reaction, and it was a student that sent me the link initially about this arc, round arc text. I was happy that it was a University of Chicago professor that was talking about this, rather than just some hack mm-hmm. off the street. So, but I'm always going to want to wait till the dust settles. I never want to just respond knee-jerk to a press release, but give it a couple of years, see what everybody says, and especially people that are specialists in the area. Mm-hmm. Not people, for example, with my level of training. I'm a Bible person first and an archaeology just by hobby, if you will. Not for us to weigh in on, but to wait for the people, the specialists, to weigh in on. Now, as far as this text, when you said the ark, you know, the text tells us the ark is round.
Yeah.
Well, we have to understand how this fits with all the ancient Near Eastern texts about the flood. You've got, going all the way back to Eridu, is the first ancient Near Eastern flood text, 2800 BC. You've got Gilgamesh epic talks about
most
flood,
famous one.
Most famous one.
Yeah.
You've got Atrakasis, which mm-hmm. is from about 1600 BC. Mm-hmm. And they all seem to be reflecting the same basic ancient Near Eastern flood account, but the size of the ark grows as time goes on. Mm-hmm. The length of the time that the waters came down grows. Gilgamesh epic, you've got a 7-story boat, okay? And yet
it's a luxury liner.
It's a luxury liner. A luxury liner. And yet it was built from the push team tearing down his reed hut.
Mm-hmm.
So the size.
Some reed hut.
Yeah, some reed hut. Well, it was 7 floors. So the size, the legends in the ancient Near East, or the tradition, keeps morphing. So if we've got one that says it was round, okay, then this is how that tradition went in that text. It doesn't necessarily mean that the original boat was round any more than it was 7 stories high.
Thanks for listening to the Table Podcast. Join us next week for part 2. For more podcasts like this one, visit dts.edu/thetable. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.